Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, July 3rd, 2015. As in the U.S., we begin the celebration of Independence Day. However, on this show, we're going to focus not on independence, but on interdependence. Americans love to talk about independence, but it's really time to stop talking about independence and start talking about interdependence. That is, our interdependence with the Earth and all of its ecosystems and all of its inhabitants. Before we get into the conversation with our guest, I'd like to mention that the phone system of Progressive Radio Network is being revamped, and while that's happening, we won't be able to take callers. We're hoping that after July 10, when the phones are back up and running at full speed, we'll be able to take callers again. I'd also like to mention that next week my guest is going to be Becca Martinson, wife of Chris Martinson, who wrote an article for the Peak Prosperity website a few years ago on how to deal with partners or family members who are not on board about collapse and catastrophic climate change. Becca is a psychotherapist and works regularly with people who are dealing with this issue, and I know this is an extremely prevalent concern for many of you, so I know you're going to want to hear Becca Martinson next week here on the Lifeboat Hour. So, a key phenomenon in the abrupt catastrophic climate change landscape is Arctic methane. And our guest today, Jennifer Hines, has become a self-taught expert on this phenomenon, and she comes to us to discuss not only Arctic methane, but the bigger picture of catastrophic climate change and the potential for near-term human extinction. And, very importantly, she will be speaking not only about the scientific landscape of the issue, but the existential and emotional dimensions as well. There are many so-called ordinary people in the world who have unique talents or skills that they use in their work or, in some cases, for entertainment, but they aren't using them for healing the planet. And when I say healing the planet, I'm not implying that if we just all do the right things, we can save the planet from the consequences of catastrophic climate change or the collapse of industrial civilization or the consequences of a mega nuclear meltdown like Fukushima. Healing isn't always synonymous with cure. But my guest today is someone who loves science and who loves to do research and who volunteered to do a video presentation on Arctic methane for a spiritual group that she and I are both involved with. And it turns out that that presentation, which is extraordinary in terms of the documentation and graphics, went viral on YouTube. The awareness that she raised in doing this presentation is stunning. Jennifer Hines is an avid climate change researcher, an environmental activist, a student of Buddhism and Eastern spirituality, and a senior IT professional. A daughter of a foreign service officer, she grew up overseas in Southeast Asia, principally Laos, and West Africa in Ghana, and she was exposed to indigenous cultures from a very early age. This early exposure to world culture in the developing world led her to a deep interest in world affairs as well as Eastern spirituality. Jennifer feels a deep sense of urgency about global warming and climate change and has studied it as a layperson for 10 years. In July of 2014, she developed a succinct presentation outlining the methane threat we face in our next chapter of Life on Earth. It's entitled, The Arctic Methane Monster's Rapid Rise. It has gone viral on the internet and has served to educate people around the world about the threat of near-term human extinction. Jennifer's continuing personal journey is one of uniting scientific discovery with the transformation of consciousness and how to find balance amidst coming chaos. Jennifer is also a friend and a fellow resident of our favorite hometown, Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Jennifer.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's so good to be here with you today. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, absolutely. Wouldn't miss it. And we tried to have you on May 29th, and we had some issues with Progressive Radio moving their studios. And so I'm thrilled that we can have you back again today and pick up where we left off. So the first question I want to ask you today, Jennifer, is how you came to create the Arctic Methane Monsters Rapid Rise YouTube presentation. Tell us a bit about the background of this amazing video and your passion in creating.
Absolutely, Carolyn. I'm really happy to share that story with you today because it's pretty interesting. So, first of all, the methane monster presentation really is the crystallization of one moment in time where I was really deeply trying to communicate the possibility of near-term human extinction to some spiritual brothers and sisters. And in attendance on that teleconference in the Tipping Point that Sunday morning in July last year were just 35 other souls, including you yourself. You were there. And it was a pivotal moment for me and for everybody who was on the phone as I launched into this material and I tried my very best to compassionately communicate the situation that we are facing here on Earth to some very concerned, courageous, and spiritual people who are willing to look at these really, really dark issues. So this presentation, now gone viral as you've noted, was given at Core Light's Tipping Point Forum. This is what was a forum that was conducted for a full year last year to study the tipping points that we're facing here on Earth. So when it was released in early August, I believe it was like August 8th, the magic happened, and that moment in time was captured and it flew off into the internet. So the rest is whatever it is. But my study of climate change has been a really personal journey, and it's been one of investigation, of discovery, and now a little bit of horror, to be honest, and you know, you just have to keep dealing with it. But I formed an emotional connection to the study of climate change, and I think to be an effective researcher, you really have to have an emotional connection and bring it all the way through your being. It's not just bits and bytes. I started about 10 or 12 years ago. There wasn't a lot of information that was out. You know, every so often I'd catch an article about Greenland or something like that. But I started doing actively internet searches probably around 2004, put in various strings, you know, Greenland melting, Arctic ice cap melting, Antarctica melting, permafrost melting, everything melting. And I was really fascinated, and I just kind of got addicted to learning about what's happening with our Earth, because we're in the most amazing period on Earth, I think, that's ever existed since the planet has existed. And if you study it, you'll probably come to those same conclusions. However, as I noted in my presentation, my big wake-up call was when I flew over Greenland in September of 2012. I was coming back from London, and I was heading over to Denver, and it was directed on a more northerly route, and I flew directly over Greenland, and I saw the ice melting, and I saw everything that was happening there on the island of Greenland, and that gave me an incredibly emotional connection with the reality of climate change as it's affecting our world. My next big kind of wake-up call was when I had the opportunity to go to Bhutan in 2014 with my lama. And I was there for a couple of weeks, and it's such a pure place and so sacred. It really galvanized my spirit. So that combined with, you know, the knowledge that I knew, I was pretty primed. It was almost kind of a setup, because when I came back from Bhutan, the Tipping Point Forum at Core Light, and that's corelight.org, corelight.org, was just beginning. And I was asked by the administrator, Victoria, to go ahead and put together a presentation on methane. And it seemed like an incredibly daunting task, but I knew it had to be done. So I just went ahead and I said I would. And once you say you would and you're you have a place that you have to be in, you know, 3 or 4 weeks to give a presentation, it kind of galvanizes you further because you really don't want to show up and not have anything good to say. So I just really threw myself into it and, you know, put together the wet methane monster to the best of my awareness and knowledge. I had gained a really deep awareness around our precarious situation on Earth, and I had spent a couple of years following this, you know, reading intensively, all these types of things. So I was able to translate a lot of very scientific information with a lot of charts and a lot of data and a lot of graphs and a lot of maps into fairly easily understood concepts. So I was kind of like a translator in that way. As well, I'd like to mention that I am working on another rendition of the methane monster that's going to be bringing in the nuclear threat. And this time I have help, which is wonderful. I'm working with Kevin Hester of New Zealand, Kevin Lister of the UK, and, you know, anybody else who wants to, you know, give me research and help me out. But it's been a continuing journey, and I see it moving into the future. This really has to be talked about.
Well, thank you for all of that background on your presentation. And the next question I have for you, Jennifer, is really straightforward. In your opinion, what are the long-term and short-term implications of the Arctic methane monster? And I have a feeling that you're going to mention the E word here, extinction.
Yeah. You know, this is a devastating topic. This really is the hardest topic to talk about. I don't especially enjoy talking about it, but it needs to be talked about. We have to find a place within ourselves, you know, with our loved ones, our friends, our communities, you know, to be able to openly have a conversation as to the state of the affairs of the world, you know, what is happening in this world. Let's not hide. And, you know, we're going to be living here today, we're going to be living here tomorrow. So it's time for us to really take a good look at this and see what's coming down the pike here. It's a really hard thing to take on board. So, you know, I'd like to kind of put in a plug for the Boulder Daily Camera newspaper. They've been running a column in there each Friday called Earth Week, and I've been reading it for years and years and years. And I love Earth Week. It's a wonderful column. And I used to have stuff in it like, you know, marmot habitat and polar bears and kind of not so serious issues, you know, kind of a fun thing to read. And then a couple of years ago, the conversation in the Boulder Daily Camera Earth Week started to change, and it became more serious, and they were talking about major earthquakes, typhoons, you know, on and on, all sorts of anomalies. So, you know, that's actually out there, and anybody can look at it. But let's take a look about where we're at and where we're probably going to go. And I'm going to reference a few people so people can, you know, do some research themselves, because I'd like everybody to reach for this information themselves. It's really easy to find. But basically, what we know, we're well above 400 parts per million in carbon dioxide. We know that the sea absorbs 97% of the heat from the carbon dioxide. And we also know that we have entered abrupt climate change. Paul Beckwith, a scientist and a professor at the University of Ottawa, and I recommend that you look up Paul Beckwith on YouTube and watch some of his amazing educational videos about climate change and what's happening with our Earth. But he himself has said that we have entered the phase of abrupt climate change. So what does that actually mean? It means that we're probably going to be experiencing some more wild weather. We know the weather has been wild, but it's going to get more wild. One plug I'd like to make right now, in the Arctic methane monster's rapid rise, I talked about the Colorado flood of 2013. In September of 2013, Colorado had a deluge. In those days, you know, 2013, a couple of years ago, deluges were not all that common or not all that well known as a phenomenon. But in the Arctic methane monster's rapid rise, I claimed that that deluge was an atmospheric river. Nobody in science had claimed yet that it was an atmospheric river. And in fact, the term atmospheric river wasn't really that well known. However, this last month, a senior scientist at NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Kevin Trenberth, he's also by way of New Zealand. Thank you, Kevin. He claimed and proved, actually, that in fact it was an atmospheric river that struck Colorado due to really high sea surface temperature anomalies in Mexico off the western coast and hurricanes that were happening in Mexico. So, you know, we are having atmospheric rivers, and in atmospheric rivers where there's a huge plume of moisture in the atmosphere that gets deposited in a very targeted fashion, as it did in Colorado. So as this wild weather really picks up, it's going to get hotter, and the permafrost, as we know, is beginning to melt up in Siberia and Alaska and Canada and all over the Arctic Circle. We have permafrost melting, and as we know, there's vast reserves of methane hydrate and methane in the permafrost and in the Arctic. And methane, as we know, is a very potent greenhouse gas, and it has a lot more heating potential than carbon dioxide. And when it hits the atmosphere, it heats up really, really quickly, and it intensifies other feedbacks. And this is what's happening actually right now in Alaska. You might have noticed that Alaska has had a huge heat wave going on lately, and we believe that methane is actually starting to come up out of the permafrost up there, and also most notably in Siberia.
And we're also noticing, Jennifer, I just might add, as you know, there have been over 300 wildfires burning in Alaska in recent weeks. And, you know, that has to be connected, I would think.
Yes, it is connected. And it's hotter, it's drier, and there are just these amazing fires that are going off in Alaska. And it's unprecedented, actually. I mean, both the temperatures and the fires are unprecedented. And, you know, Alaska's been up in the 90s, and that's very, actually, it's historic. It's not just atypical. It hasn't happened like this ever before that we know of. So, you know, we are in a really tough, tough situation as a world. And as the methane comes out, it gets hotter instantly. It's not like carbon dioxide, where it takes like 20 to 40 years to heat up. Actually, the methane heats up right away. That combined with the fact that there's already 5% more water vapor in the atmosphere than there was in the 1950s. So now you've got heat and you've got water. And as we've already noted, sea surface temperature anomalies are very, very high. So what we're finding is we're having very dramatic atmospheric thermodynamics, and it's causing wild weather worldwide. And we find that deluges are, it's a word that's now entering our vocabulary, deluges, you know, very bizarre weather events. You know, they always say, oh, this is a 1,000-year flood. Well, how many 1,000-year floods can you have all over the world, you know? So, you know, in terms of carbon dioxide, let's just talk real briefly about that. It takes about 20 to 40 years to heat up. You know, it's kind of like when you put a pot on the stove. It doesn't boil instantly. So this fact alone, if you think about it, this is sort of the death nail in the coffin of humanity. Very sorry to say this. I don't like saying this stuff, you know. But the other thing is, this realization hasn't taken hold yet in our world. So we're living in sort of a dualized reality. You know, those of us who've woken up to this situation, you know, we're walking around and it's business as usual. And yet we know in the background that this is happening. So this panic and realization of our pending doom hasn't really come upon the world yet. And, you know, this terrible vision just hasn't taken hold yet. It possibly will at some point. Let's see. We're going to have to see how the play of demise plays out, because it's expressing itself in deluges, in droughts like California, in powerful hurricanes, in typhoons. It's kind of like death by a million cuts. You know, it's not one thing that's going to kill you, but it's like poking all over the earth. And I really like to make a big plug for Pope Francis. It's non-trivial that the Pope has released his papal encyclical this past month. I'd also like to note that Pope Francis wrote this encyclical himself. He is a scientist, in case you don't know. Prior to his entering the clergy, Pope Francis was a chemist, and he knows a lot about science, and he's a big fan of science, and he wrote the entire papal encyclical. I think it's some like 280 pages long, and it's also non-trivial that this encyclical has since been endorsed by the Dalai Lama, by many religious leaders, by Jewish leaders, by, you know, political leaders. Pope Francis knows what's going on, and he's very alarmed, and he has taken action. So this is a huge development. There's some consciousness solidarity that's building there. So, yes.
He has also called Naomi Klein to the Vatican to work with her and get some advice from her on this. And I just think that's just amazing. You know, Naomi Klein, she's Jewish, a very non-religious person, but one of the foremost voices in the climate conversation. And, you know, he's called her there. I think that's pretty cool.
It absolutely is. I followed that as well. Naomi Klein is the author of This Changes Everything, a pivotal book on climate change and the world situation. She's a tireless activist, and she is working directly with papal envoys to team up and build up this consciousness and whatever effect it's going to take in the outside world. I'm so happy that this is happening. It's really bringing together religion and science, and it really needs to happen.
I have another question for you, Jennifer, that just came into me yesterday, and I don't want to throw you a curve, but one of my subscribers to the Daily News Digest asked if, you know, what does any of this have to do with geoengineering in the Arctic? Do you have any information about that?
It's always an interesting topic to talk about geoengineering. I know about geoengineering. I don't study it particularly. I think that, you know, whether there's geoengineering going on or not, whether chemtrails are going on or not, the pollution that we put out as a civilization, you know, all 7.3 billion of us, as we go about our lives and live our lives, you know, all the pollution that comes up from that, all the carbon dioxide that comes up from burning all this coal and, you know, our cars, et cetera, that alone is enough to do what is happening. And, you know, geoengineering may be going on. I'm really not qualified to talk about it. All I could say was, you know, repeat other things that I've heard. So I don't know for sure whether geoengineering is going on. If it is going on, and they are in fact releasing a sulfur dioxide mix of some sort mixed in with jet fuel or whatever it is that they may be doing with geoengineering, and there may be different types of geoengineering, what they're saying is that, you know, the additional particulation causes a lot more deluge activity within the atmosphere because the water molecules actually bond around this particulation. And when it comes out of the atmosphere, it causes huge giant deluges. As well, it causes solar dimming, which is kind of an offset to the, you know, carbon dioxide, you know, and heat that we're feeling. So actually, the solar dimming would be cooling our Earth for a couple of degrees. And that would, if this is true, and I believe that that part is, you know, just with general pollution and jet fuel and everything else, then if we did end industrial civilization, not that we would have a choice to do so, but if industrial civilization ends, then immediately the Earth would heat by another couple of degrees as the offset of the particulation just kind of washes out of the atmosphere very quickly.
Today we're talking on the Lifeboat Hour with Jennifer Hines, who created a must-watch YouTube video entitled The Arctic Methane Monster, which is one of the best presentations of the facts regarding Arctic methane, as well as a detailed analysis of the chilling, no pun intended, catastrophic consequences of the Arctic methane monster. You can find the presentation on YouTube. And Jennifer, how can folks contact you?
The best way to get in touch with me is find me on Facebook. So if they go either to Guy McPherson's friend page or your friend page or Paul Beckwith's friend page, they'll find me there. And there are several Jennifer Hineses in the world, so you really kind of have to find me by association. But I'm not really too hard to find. I do chat with people, and, you know, it's a big thing to talk about. So a lot of people are feeling the need to reach out.
Very good. Thanks for that. And let's just cut to the chase here, Jennifer. Extinction brings up questions of our own personal death and our thoughts and feelings about dying. What do you see as the difference between extinction and individual death?
What an interesting question that is, right? So, you know, the moment you allow yourself to accept the strong possibility of near-term human extinction, you are, almost by definition, thrown into a process, a deep process, a process that just racks you to the bone, that will last for the rest of your physical life, because the process is that big. It is intense. When I myself started waking up to this, and I started grokking the fact that we were actually on this trajectory as a planet, I went into panic, and I didn't really have anybody to talk about it at this time. And as I gathered more information, I understood at a very visceral level what was happening to us. And I started waking up like at 3 a.m, and my heart would just be pounding in my chest. And I was scared. It was almost like I was waking up on behalf of the Earth, and I was scared for what was happening. And I was actually terrified as I began to understand more and more clearly that our entire civilization, as well as the other living things on this Earth, because please remember, we are not the only things on this planet. We may be the biggest and nastiest predators on the planet, but this planet is, you know, home to millions of species. And so I started having these night awakenings, which really kind of furthered and fueled my research, because I was just so panicked about the whole thing. So when you start to study this, it can bring up huge, giant, deep fears and triggers and all sorts of things, and you start to grapple with this, and it causes like cognitive dissonance, and you can't believe it, and you go back and forth about what you think. And these ideas and concepts, they really had only been relegated to like some sort of sci-fi fantasy doom film or something like that as a distinct possibility where we're heading on as a species on this planet, you know. And so when you go through this process, not only do you feel like the extinction of other beings on the planet, the human species on the planet, but you start to feel intensively your own death. You start to intensively understand you are not going to live together. You're not sure what's going to kill you, but for sure you're going to die, you know? And so we examine the eco-dissolution that's happening around us here on Earth, and we're witness to this, you know, day by day on our own very beautiful planet. And we come to these realizations, you know, life is hung in the balance here, you know, and we have recently, you know, probably as recently as 10 years ago or so, tipped over a very steep and slippery, icy slope into this cycle of demise. And so we are here to witness this. That's all I can figure it out, you know, and we're going to find ourselves on this incredible journey. What we'll find, it's really anybody's guess. But I do think there's a distinct possibility of near-term human extinction. And I'd like to just talk about that term real briefly. So the expression near-term human extinction, it's relatively new in the scientific literature. But unlike other truths that have been successfully suppressed by the national elites and their corporate media, this one is going to keep filtering out until you start to hear this expression routinely. It is impossible to suppress. And the reason is because it's the truth. This is a big truth, and it's simply too big to suppress permanently in the planetary environment, you know, and it's our own environment is going to deliver us some messages in the form of like catastrophic environmental events as we see playing out all over the world. And whether the corporate media covers this or not is irrelevant. It's going to happen nonetheless.
So one of the things that immediately comes up for us when we open our minds to the possibility of near-term human extinction, of course, is our own mortality, our own death, which, of course, is one reason that people don't want to talk about this, and that we only hear this term near-term human extinction in certain circles. Now, one of the things that I'm curious about is that you speak of using death as an advisor. What do you mean by that? Not taking life for granted, I think, is part of what you mean. Go ahead and just elaborate on that, please.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Carolyn. You know, we have to start to live in the present and understand that we are mortal, that our physical bodies are going to die, and we have a limited amount of time in which to address our lives and address this catastrophe and address everything else and to love other people in it. So, you know, feeling magic in the moment, feeling the joy of life in the face of death, you know, all of these things. Now, I'd like to kind of put a plug in for Carlos Castaneda. Those of you who read his books back in the 70s, you know, probably love them. I think he started actually writing them in the 60s. But there's one he wrote that's notable. It's Journey to Ixlan. And he hung out with a guy called Don Juan. Now, whether he's real or not, it doesn't really matter. But I'd like to put a plug in here and read you a little quote from Journey to Ixlan about using death as an advisor. Death is the only wise advisor that we have. Whenever you feel, as you do, that everything is going wrong and you're about to be annihilated, turn to your death and ask if that is so. Your death will tell you that you're wrong, that nothing really matters outside its touch. Your death will tell you, I haven't touched you yet. So we have this time. You know, also in the Buddhist tradition, they talk a lot about death. And I'd like to read you a little thing from Death and Dying in the Buddhist tradition. So contemplation and meditation on death and impermanence are regarded as very important in Buddhism for two reasons. It's only by recognizing how precious and how short life is that we're most likely to make it meaningful and live it fully. And it's also by understanding the death process and familiarizing ourselves with it, we can remove fear at the time of death and ensure a good rebirth. So lots of different traditions focus on death as using death as an advisor. And I think it's very good for us to contemplate our death and the fact that we are mortal frequently to enjoy and treasure living life in the present.
Well, thank you for the answer to that question, Jennifer, your answer, and I really value it. Those of you who are regular listeners to the Lifeboat Hour, you know that when possible, I like to break up the conversation with my guest by pausing for a song. And here's a song today that Jennifer requested. This is Before the Deluge with Jackson Browne.
Feathers once so fine, ooh. and exchange love's bright and fragile glow for the glitter and the rouge. And in a moment they were swept before the deluge. Now let the music keep our spirits high. Buildings keep our children proud. Let creation reveal its secrets by and by. By and by. When the light that's lost within us reaches the sky. Some of them at the way the earth was abused by the man who learned how to forge her beauty into power. And they struggled to protect her from them, only to be confused by the magnitude of her fury in the final hour. After the deluge, let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children dry. Let creation reveal its secrets by and by.
That was Jackson Brown singing Before the Deluge, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and today we're talking with Jennifer Hines, creator of the YouTube presentation, The Arctic Methane Monster's Rapid Rise. Before I go back to Jennifer, I just want to remind everyone that last year, Guy McPherson and I published our wonderful book together called Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, and we're going to be seeing the second edition of this book coming out in August or September of this year. We encourage you to pick it up, to order it, either in hardcover or in paperback or in ebook form. It comes in all forms. This is a beautiful integration of science and spirituality, which is part of what we're talking about today with Jennifer Hines. So I want to go back to Jennifer and just notice that this is about the biggest topic that any human being can deal with. And because it's so huge and terrifying and daunting, most people don't deal with it. How do you suggest that each of us deal with it when, you know, when we wake up to it? Certainly, we can't try to be alone with this, right?
Absolutely, Carolyn. We need community now more than we've ever needed it. And we also need methods and strategies, and we need ways to look at this information. It's so powerful and so devastating. And I'd like to direct people to a Norwegian eco-psychologist named Per Esten Stoknes. That's Per Esten Stoknes. And he has been working with this information about how to get people to deal with this concept of near-term human extinction and how to work with it. So let's take a look. So when people first encounter near-term human extinction and the demise and everything that we're finding ourselves in on this planet, they experience what Per Esten Stoknes has called the 5 Ds. You know, you get a sense of distance. Let's kind of move ourselves away from the topic. Let's not talk about it. Let's make it seem like something in the future. We get a feeling of doom. This doom can lead us to fear, which actually will also lead consequently to passivity and will cannot actually lead to avoidance of the topic altogether. We also enter kind of a cognitive dissonance, and we can't even really comprehend how could this world end. This world is forever. This world has always been here. This world will always be here. It'll always be the same. You know, we cannot believe that this is happening, so we enter a space of dissonance. Another D is denial. We can say, not exist, doesn't happen, not here, no, they're wrong. I don't believe in science. Science is wrong. We also can kind of find identity around this. So like if the people that we associate with don't believe in this for some reason, you know, we're a member of some group or something that doesn't believe in this, we can say, oh, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is not part of my political agenda. This is not part of my religious agenda. I don't believe this because all my people around me don't believe it either. I would like to add a 6th D, and that is damn mad. Or damn angry. And you get mad. It's like, what? This has happened? How can this be? This is so stupid. This is so impossible. I cannot believe that this is happening, right? So we need strategies to deal with these types of things. So one strategy that we can do and employ right away is social networks. And I'd really like to put in a big plug for Facebook. Facebook has been really helpful for me dealing with this. There's a lot of information on Facebook. There are people on Facebook. They're real people. They're good people. They're smart people. As a matter of fact, I'd like to put in a plug for the near-term human extinctionists out on Facebook because they are some of the most smart people I've ever met, and they are dedicated to finding out what's going on. And it's a great place to process this information. And I have had friendships in Facebook translate to friendships outside of Facebook, so it's wonderful. So we have to find more supportive friendships, you know, whether it be our romantic associations, our family, our personal friends, you know. It really helps if other people understand where you're coming from. I'd also like to kind of put in a plug for myself. I was really scared to come out and tell my dad about this, for instance, because it just represented so much. And I finally, I was interviewing with Kevin Hester on the near-term, or on the Extinction Radio. I guess this was back in, I don't remember, April or something like that. And I said at that time, oh, well, I could never tell my dad because my dad's never going to be supportive of this and he's just going to flip out and he's going to be like all scared and he's going to be worried for me. And I made up all these reasons why I could never tell my dad that I've done all this stuff. So, of course, the first thing I did is, you know, the day after Kevin's radio show, I went down and saw my dad down in Tucson and I'm like, hey, Dad. What up? You know, and I told all about this. So he has become one of my most ardent supporters, and he understands, and he actually agrees with me that we are on this path of, you know, this trajectory of doom. And, you know, my dad's a Foreign Service officer. He had been for 30 years. He understands the world and he understands how the world works, and he actually agrees with me. So that's, you know, get in touch with your family and your friends. Also, try and integrate simple actions that'll help you out in your outlook. So there are certain things you can do. Like say you get really depressed and it's just not working, you know, and you just can't get out of it. One thing you can do is you can start to what? Breathe. You can actually shift yourself out of a negative state of mind to a positive one if you focus on your breath. So if you're in a bad mood and it's hurting your performance and it's hurting your friendships, how do you get out of it? First thing is breathe. Breathing can help you achieve a psychological condition called coherence, and it improves your mental clarity, your focus, your emotional stability, and your decision making. And also you can activate a positive feeling and focus on it. So what you focus on, you become. So I myself practice Buddhist ritual, which involves chanting sacred texts and singing sacred texts. It helps me to kind of vibrationally purify my being and makes me stronger. So there are a lot of simple actions that you can incorporate. Tell yourself better stories. Don't focus on this doom all the time. It's not a good idea. It will lead to mental imbalance, and you really need to keep all your mental capabilities and wherewithal about you. So, you know, live in the now. Live it. Focus on love, focus on positive things. Don't focus on the doom all the time. It's important to know it's there, but don't focus on it as like an ongoing thing. It just doesn't work in the long run, and it doesn't make you happy either. And this life is precious. We have to live in the now. Other things you can do is give yourself new signals, incorporating new practices. I myself practice yoga. I think it makes me strong and happy. And I, you know, encourage everybody to incorporate practices in their life that's going to work. Oh, also on Facebook, I'm going to put one more plug into Facebook. Please check out the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group. That'll get you started. And, you know, from there are dozens of other groups that you can join.
There is also a support group on Facebook for parents. It's called Whistling in the Dark. And that is for folks who understand what we're talking about and speak the same language.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So, Jennifer, as you know, I'm not a religious person, but I have the greatest respect for the Buddhist tradition, which I feel, in the case of near-term human extinction, has a great deal to teach us. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about what Buddhism has taught you about NTHE, and then also if you could combine that, because we're running down to the end of the hour, a little bit about afterlife. I realize that not everyone believes in an afterlife, but I know you do. And I'd like to hear a little bit about how the perspective of an afterlife influences our experience of the impending near-term human extinction.
Sure. I'll try and cover all of those in 7 minutes. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a challenge. Let's see if we can do it.
Okay.
So, yes, I am a Buddhist. I have been a Buddhist for a long time. I grew up in a Buddhist country. I was exposed to Buddhism in all concepts of reincarnation and afterlife from the age of 9. I've, you know, was exposed to Buddhist monks by the age, you know, from the age of 9. So this is not an unusual thing for me to be a Buddhist, even though it might seem odd to some people. I do study with a Lama. It's Lama Karma Rinpoche, Lama Karma Nangyel Rinpoche, who is from Bhutan, and I've known him and studied with him for 17 years. So Buddhism has always stressed the importance of squarely confronting the reality of death. A lot of Buddhism has to do with the study of death. And it's not a pessimistic thing. It's just because they know that death comes to all beings. And because of this emphasis, Buddhism has sometimes been associated with like a pessimistic outlook on life, but it's the opposite, really, because death is absolutely inevitable for every single one of us listening today. Any attempt to ignore it or to, you know, put it under the carpet as the most basic fact of life condemns us to a superficial mode of living. So if you want to really live, you really have to accept your death. You have to have a clear awareness and an understanding of the nature of death. And this can help you live with strength and clarity and purpose and joy. Now, I think Buddhism and near-term extinction are similar. They're both anti-hopium, if you know that word. And they invite us to have an unadorned look at reality. a kind of strange practice that they have in Tibet is sky burial, because the ground is very hard. So they leave the bodies out for the birds, and they get chomped on and eaten by these vultures. It sounds absolutely horrible and disgusting. But these are called the charnel grounds. And it's said that the Buddha actually encouraged his students to meditate in the charnel grounds as a way of releasing the ultimate attachment. And that's the attachment to one's body and to life itself. So this practice is meant to be uncomfortable and challenging. And as far as afterlife, Carolyn, as you said, not everybody believes in the afterlife, but I do. I do. I have a very strong feeling about the afterlife. Just like us to take a look at the atom. You know, we know from quantum physics and atomic physics and the study of the atom that the atom is 99.99% empty space. By definition, that means that we are actually comprised of empty space if you look at it from the atomic level. And it also means that this entire physical universe is comprised of 99.99% empty space. And it's really an expression of energy. You know, we have to take a look at consciousness. You know, consciousness is the absolutely most profound mystery in the universe. Now, if you're interested in studying about the afterlife, I'd like you to invite you to look at the work of Eben Alexander. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. This was endorsed by Raymond Moody, pivotal doctor who wrote Life After Life. And it's a courageous book, and it tackles the question of life after life with science, philosophy, and a heart-rending experience. Dr. Eben Alexander actually died. He was a he is a doctor. He's still a practicing doctor. He got a very tough disease that you can read about, and his brain actually went dead, and he actually died and was in a deep coma and had a tremendously profound experience while he was in coma, and his brain was actually physically offline. And it's a fascinating book. I recommend everyone.
It is a fascinating book, and I might just add, his experience is one of hundreds of thousands of experiences that we now have from people who say that they have died and come back, and they all have one thing in common, and that is that they almost always, almost without exception, experience unconditional love.
Absolutely. Everybody who's gone through this experience comes back absolutely transformed with a completely different outlook on life and takes a look at it and realizes that at our core, our physical beings are actually an expression of consciousness. I'd like to, Max Planck was a theoretical physicist who got the Nobel Prize back in 1918, a very famous man, and he also believed in life after life. So listen to this. He says, I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness. This is interesting. Consciousness is the way we perceive and observe the world, the way we think, our intentions and feelings, and more. So one of the biggest questions about human consciousness is whether it is a product of our brain, or is our brain actually a receiver of consciousness? So if consciousness is not a product of the brain, then it would mean that human physicality is not required for the continuation of consciousness. And that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is. Well, I'm with you, Jennifer. I happen to believe that these near-death experiences are more than just a firing of synapses in the brain, and that consciousness is much more than the brain. So we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you, Jennifer Hines, for being with us today and for your amazing work in the world. Thank you for
joining us, everyone who's on the show today. We're going to be archiving this show very soon. The podcast may be up this afternoon. Please come back and join us next week when our guest will be Becca Martinson, who's going to talk about living, loving, and preparing with a reluctant partner. Becca is the wife of Chris Martinson of the Peak Prosperity website, and she's an expert on helping people who are in relationships with partners who may not see the global crisis in the same way that you do. You're not going to want to miss this show. Again, Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you can join us again after you update your presentation.
I'll be happy to be back, Carolyn. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good week, everybody, and a safe 4th of July.
Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows you really do. Everybody.